"Open the book," I commanded, perhaps a little too forcefully. "Let's get on with it." She looked at me. I looked at her. "I can't wait to hear your professional opinion, Daff," I improvised. "I'm a complete duffer when it comes to literary excellence." With all the cool confidence of a Mona Lisa with all the aces, she cradled the book in her left palm and opened it to the first page. She let out a whistle.
"Crikey," she said. "Listen to this. It's the dedication. There's also a dedicatory poem. To mine own Leander. The copper mare and the brass stallion graze in Flecker's field. He paws the turf while she the wind tastes, and when he trots to her, she turns tail."
"I don't understand it," I said. "Does it mean anything?"
"Only to the discerning eye," Daffy said.
"Then you'd better explain," I told her. "I have no time to piddle about with poetry."
"Pity," Daffy said. "You might learn something."
"Such as?"
I was already becoming impatient. "To begin with, Leander was a character in Greek mythology. He fell in love with a nun named Hero."
"Hold on," I said. "Hero is a man's name."
"It is now, yes. But in those days, it was a woman's. Before men reduced real history to rubble, then raked over the ruins, like a dog burying and digging up its, well, you know."
"Bone," I said, but Daffy ignored me.
"This Leander tried to swim the Hellespont at night, but a storm blew up and drowned him."
"Drowned? At night?" This was becoming intriguing.
"What about Flecker's Field?" I asked. "I've never heard of the place. Is it around here somewhere?"
"Possibly," Daffy said. "But James Elroy Flecker was the name of a poet who died during the Great War."
"In battle?" I asked. "In bed," Daffy said. "Not in the field, but in bed, of tuberculosis, in Switzerland."
"I don't see the point," I said. I was glad I had taken up poisons rather than poetry, which seems to me more baffling than belladonna.
"The point is," Daffy said, "that Flecker's Field, in one of its senses, was poetry, you know. Have you heard? That silence where the birds are dead, yet something pipeth like a bird."
Invisible feathers tickled my spine. I was going to have to look into this Flecker chap. Perhaps I was even going to have to rethink poetry.
"Aha," I said, "I understand," although actually I didn't. "So obviously," she went on, "the reference could be to some poet other than herself."
"But wait," I said, "if Flecker's Field refers to poetry, then it might just as well be Mrs. Palmer's own field, since she's a poet herself." Daffy gave me a skeptical look.
"Or," I said, holding up a forefinger to emphasize a brilliant idea, "it might be an actual field. Is there a field belonging to the oaken pheasant?"
"I doubt it," Daffy frowned. "Modern poets are seldom literal, unless they live abroad in the colonies, of course. Still, I expect your idea might be worth looking into. Do you think we might find a real copper mare and a real brass stallion? Maybe it's a horse breeder we're looking for, or a racetrack."
"Or a railway," Daffy added, clapping me on the shoulders, "the iron horse and all that."
Although I nearly fainted with surprise, I bore up remarkably well.
"And what about the rest of it?" I asked. "All that pawing of the turf and the tasting of the wind and so forth."
Daffy got up from the bed and went to the window, peering down into the sunken garden where Feely and Dieter were strolling round and round in circles, arm in arm. She turned and gave me a long, cold, calculated look, as if she were weighing whether to entrust me with some deep, dark secret. After what seemed to me like hours, but couldn't have been more than a quarter of a minute, she said,
"Leave that to me."
"Righty-ho," I said. We had agreed, Daffy and I, that each of us would follow her own lines of investigation. Not that I intended to, of course. Not for a mayfly's minute. What Daffy didn't realize was that we were aiming at two different targets. While her intent was to unravel the mysteries of a book of poetry, mine was to catch a killer. I had no idea what she knew about Orlando Whitbread, and I didn't want to ask her. With her nose forever in a book, Daffy was no great authority on today's front page, or yesterday's for that matter. In her estimation, the world had come to an end in 1870. Nothing worthwhile had been written or published since the death of Charles Dickens on the 9th of June in that year. Although she read more modern works, it was simply to exercise her eyes, or so she claimed. And so it was I who scanned the morning papers for the lurid crimes. I had begun, of course, with the avalanches of ancient newspapers that tumbled out of every cupboard at Buckshaw, many of which dated back a century or more. From their brittle, yellowing pages, I had read with fascination about the cream of the criminal element. Haig, Armstrong, Crippen, the list went on and on. Once begun, it was hard to break the habit, and I was already hungering for much more current news. Mrs. Mallet was only too happy to bring me the latest papers every day, after her husband had finished with them. "Alf gets up with the sparrows every morning," she told me, "so as to be at the newsagent's when they rolls up the blinds. Alf says he can't help it, has to find out what they're up to at Westminster. That lot needs keeping an eye on. Our Agnes says he's what's called an invertebrate reader." Agnes Mallet had left home some years ago to study Pitman shorthand, and had since come to be considered, at least by Alf and Mrs. M., the world's greatest authority on anything which involved printed matter. Unlike the great Sherlock Holmes, I did not keep a commonplace book other than the one that was in my head. Who could ever forget, for instance, even the tiniest detail of the acid bath murders, in which John George Haig dissolved as few as six and as many as a dozen bodies in vats of concentrated sulfuric acid? At the risk of sounding ghoulish, I swear that these titbits were etched permanently into my brain. To put it bluntly, I was more accustomed than Daffy to dealing with death, while she was more accustomed to dealing with Dickens. Which is all right, I suppose, if you feel you might be seized suddenly by little red men from Mars in their flying saucers and transported back to Victorian times. Which is why I decided to keep my intentions to myself. By now, it was getting late in the day. If I got a move on, I might even be back at the Oak and Pheasant in time for tea. Chapter 12 Shadrach's circus and menagerie, all in all, was rather a shabby affair. A half-dozen ancient pantechnicons were drawn up in a rough circle round the market square, like a wagon train under attack. Although they had the appearance of military vehicles, which had barely survived the First World War, these sagging vehicles were painted in gaudy colours with the name of the circus, as well as garish images and slogans, "Man-eating tigers, lions, elephants, see the savage beasts." All of these and more were portrayed on the panels with oversized heads, snarling mouths, and teeth the size of icicles. A crouching cheetah was preparing to bring down a white Arabian stallion, which was rearing up, red nostrils flaring and eyes rolling in terror. What would Hop think of such a dramatic scene, I wondered, or was it too unreal? Nearby, in a wheeled cage, a rather moth-eaten lion was sleeping on its back, with feet in the air. To one side of the cage, the lone elephant, still chained by its leg to a post in the ground, munched thoughtfully on a stray newspaper. There were no tigers in sight. A steam organ, sadly out of tune and sounding like defective plumbing, was playing the opening theme song for the wireless program The Archers, which seemed especially pathetic. Dum-dee-dumpity-dum-dee-dum, dum-dee-dum-dee-dum-dee, and so on, almost to distraction. Every one of the piercing notes was a new assault upon my ears. It was like being under attack by a swarm of those wasps that drill through the skin of baby figs to lay their eggs. On a raised platform, a tall, thin man with a bare chest, but wearing suspenders, was swallowing a sword for an audience of two small boys who were fighting over a bag of apples. The sword swallower put down his blade and began juggling five metal rings. But it made no difference. The apple war raged on. I was wondering where to begin my investigations when a voice behind me said, "Look who's here again. Mistles, did you?" I spun round to find myself face to face with the man in the polka-dot kerchief. This time he was with his two friends. I stepped back instinctively. All three of them had their hands in their pockets, and all three had something in their mouths. One a toothpick, one a wooden matchstick, and Polka Dot a cigarette.
"Come to see the menagerie, have you?" Matchstick asked. "Come to see the man-eating tigers?"
Polka Dot snickered and blew a showy smoke ring. That did it.
"Actually," I said, "I'm looking into the death of Orlando Whitbread, the man who was fished out of the river this morning."
I realized as soon as I said it that this was a hugely risky business. I was not only tossing away my anonymity, but also, possibly, putting my life in jeopardy. What if one of these bruisers was a killer? What if one, or two, or perhaps even all three of them, had dumped Orlando into the water? Any one of these muscle-bound hulks could have overpowered his thin body with ease. I watched their eyes carefully for the slightest sign of alarm, but there seemed to be no reaction other than amusement.
"Friend of yours, was he?"
Polka Dot asked, looking from one to the other of his pals, as if he had made a capital joke.
"A relative, actually," I lied. "A cousin, a distant cousin, to be sure, but a cousin nonetheless."
"Nonetheless?"
Polka Dot coughed out the word in a cloud of smoke.
"Hark her, Nigel, nonetheless, nonetheless," she says.
"Nonetheless,"
Matchstick replied with a grin, and I deduced that he must be Nigel.
"One of the Torquay Whitbreads," I went on, ignoring their stupid banter.
"On my grandmother's side, obviously.
My Aunt Gregoria always predicted that Orlando would meet a watery death. 'You can count on it,' she used to say. And she was right. Of course, Aunt Gregoria had more than a little of the psychic about her, which might have given her a bit of an unfair advantage, don't you think, Mr.?"
"Terence," Polka Dot said. "How do you do?" I asked, sticking out my hand and trying not to gag.
Terence's paw was black with circus grease and grime and knobbly with hardened calluses. To the touch, it was like hand-wrestling with an engine room oiler.
I would need to concoct a disinfectant as soon as I got back to the Oaken Pheasant.
"And you are?" I asked, offering my tainted hand to Matchstick.
"Nigel," he said, taking my fingers in his fist, and I almost laughed.
"You don't look like a Nigel," I said gaily. "More like a Pierre or a Jean-Baptiste, but perhaps it's your neckerchief."
His neckerchief was gaily striped with blue, white, and red, like the French tricolour flag. I suppose it could equally have been red, white, and blue, like the British, but I wanted to flatter him. I held out my hand to the third ruffian, Toothpick, and raised my eyebrows. His light blue neckerchief matched his eyes.
"Cornell," he said quietly. "Pleased to meet you, miss."
"Dorchester," I said. "Arabella Dorchester, but you can call me Arab. Everybody else does."
"Hold on," Terence protested. "That's not the name your sister gave us."
I arranged my features into a look of surprise.
"Betty?"
I asked, letting my mouth fall open in disbelief.
"Oh, she's such an awful liar. She's always telling people she's Lady Lancaster or Dame Agatha Dimbleby. Who did she tell you she was?"
"Ophelia Deluce," said Nigel, looking like a man bamboozled. "That scallywag," I said, shaking my head. "I'm so ashamed of her. I really must apologize on Betty's behalf." The three roustabouts were looking distinctly uneasy. I had deftly turned the tables on them and got the upper hand. There was no time to lose.
"Now then," I asked, taking command as if it were I who had arranged our meeting. "How long have you gentlemen been in town?"
3 days, Cornell answered obediently, counting today, that is.
I shot him a beaming smile as a reward, and from that moment on the poor lad was eating out of my hand.
"And you?"
I said, turning to Terence. I had already sized him up as the ringleader.
"Are you in charge of these great beastly machines?"
I asked, waving a hand toward the parked pantechnicons.
"Gosh, they must be jolly difficult to drive."
I almost reached out to feel one of his bulging biceps, but I restrained myself. Terence drew in a deep breath.
I had him.
"Well, then," I said, rubbing my hands together, "about Cousin Orlando, I'm sure Aunt Gregoria would be willing to offer a generous reward for information. Just to put her mind to rest, you understand. Orlando was more or less her pet, you know. Actually, she spoiled him outrageously."
"We seen him round about, here and there,"
Terence said, shifting his shoulders and looking away, trying to disguise the telltale glitter in his eyes.
"I'm surprised to hear that," I said. "I should have thought you'd have seen a great deal more of him. Cousin Orlando was simply mad about circuses. More than mad, he had a bee in his bonnet about them. He didn't beg to run away with you, did he? To be trained as a clown, offered to work for nothing?"
"He never said anything like that to us," Nigel volunteered,
which told me what I wanted to know. They had talked to Orlando. He had still been alive when they arrived in town the day before yesterday. More to the point, they had been here when he died.
"What did he say then?" I asked, turning to Cornell.
"We had a few drinks with him, is all," Cornell said, "at the Wooden Bird."
"The Wooden Bird?" I asked.
"The Oaken Pheasant. It's kind of a joke. We've always called it that."
"Why?" I asked.
Cornell shrugged.
"Who knows? Same reason the landlord is always called Gov, no matter his real name. It's a tradition. You might as well ask why they always drop bread in the churchyard or dance round the maypole with wooden hobby horses."
"Always?" I asked. "You've been here before?"
"Shadrax has been stopping here since Napoleon was in nappies," Terence said.
"And which of you is Mr. Shadrax?" I said.
All three of them laughed at once, as if their mouths were tied together with a string.
"Mr. Shadrach went to his reward when Queen Victoria was on the throne, if you'll pardon the expression," Terence said.
Again came the clockwork laughs, but only two this time.
"Then who's the proprietor nowadays?" I asked. "Cousin Orlando may have approached him."
"Approached her, you mean," Terence told me. "Mrs. Dandyman, Dreadnought Dandyman, we call her."
The three of them broke into sniggers, and I noticed that Cornell looked cautiously over his shoulder.
"Because she's an old battleship," he explained. "A Dreadnought is a battlecruiser from the time of World War I.
HMS Colossus and HMS Collingwood, for instance," I said. "I'd show them I knew my peas from my pickles." I had often enough pored over the ancient picture magazines, which simply bulged to bursting with photographs of British naval power. Not one of the three seemed to be able to come up with a reply.
"And where might I find Mrs. Dandyman?" I asked, following the line of Cornell's glance, which was toward the largest of the pantechnicons, the one with the stallion and the cheetah.
"Over there, in Buckinghorse Palace," Nigel said. "Just don't tell her we told you."
"Bit of a tartar, is she?" I asked.
Terence gave off a noise that sounded as if his sinuses had collapsed.
"Judge for yourself," he said as he turned and walked away,
with Nigel and Cornell hard on his heels. Behind the backs of his two pals, Cornell twiddled his fingers goodbye. A slight chill touched my bare arms as I stepped into the shadow of the pantechnicon. The sheer tonnage of the thing loomed over me like a vast red whale. My first task was to find the entrance, which was not easy. The metal skin of the thing appeared to be seamless, and the enormous murals of the beasts made it even more difficult to find a door. After a complete walk around without success, I finally spotted a small set of folding stairs, cunningly concealed among the roots of a painted jungle tree. Only then did I spot the door, its hinges hidden by the artist's idea of bark. "Someone," I thought, "is particular about her privacy," and I couldn't help but wonder why. I gave the steps a gentle pull, more as a test than anything, and was astonished when they folded out and down without a sound.
"Hello?" I called. "Mrs. Dandyman, are you there?"
Again in silence, the steps folded themselves up as they retracted and locked into place with a metallic click. It was as if they had never existed.
"Hydraulic," I thought. "How clever."
They could be opened and closed from the inside as well as from the outside, which made sense. All I needed to do was find the push button, which wasn't all that difficult once you knew what you were looking for. And yes, here it was, not a button, but a switch, cunningly disguised as one of the tiger's claws. I looked round to see if anyone was watching me, but Terence and his chums had wandered away from the pantechnicon, leaving me alone in the shadow of the thing. No one would see me climb aboard, if I was able to. If I vanished from the face of the earth, no one would ever know where I had gone. Orlando's fish-nibbled features sprang suddenly into my mind.
"Mrs. Dandyman," I called again, "I'd like to speak with you."
When there was no answer, I reached out and flipped the switch. The silent steps came down, and with the slightest hiss of air, such as you might expect from an alien spaceship, like the one Michael Rennie stepped out of in The Day the Earth Stood Still, the metal door slowly began to open.
"Hello?"
I called out into the darkness, placing a foot on the lowest tread. When no one told me to keep out or to go away, I took it as an invitation and climbed aboard. To my right was a heavy hanging curtain. I pulled it aside, foolhardy perhaps, but I did it anyway, and walked through. I couldn't suppress a gasp. The cavernous space, I hesitate to call it a room, was filled with paintings, a dozen or so, each on its own altar, and each illuminated by a row of flickering candles. A private chapel, I thought. In one of the paintings, a man flayed to his bare muscles, stood holding his own skin, draped over his arm like a toga. In another, a nearly naked man was being grilled over a makeshift stove by men with lances. And in yet another, a woman armed only with a crucifix was using it as a blade to cut her way out of a dragon's belly.
"Chamber of Horrors, isn't it?" said a voice. "Better run away before something nasty happens to you."
I hadn't seen her there, half hidden as she was by a hanging curtain. She took a step toward me, a pointed object in her hand. I was already preparing to take to my heels when I realized that her weapon was an artist's paintbrush. As she stepped out of the shadows, I could see that the woman had been working on a canvas of a group of men, bound together by weighted chains, being tossed over the side of a ship and into the sea, while nearby, on the shore, another man hung from a cross, surrounded by a swarm of bees.
"They're beautiful," I exclaimed. "Every one of them."
"That's Saint Astius on the cross, isn't it? He was covered in honey and left in the hot sun to be stung to death by bees." The woman took another step toward me, her candle-lit face blazing like a comet in the half-darkness, her grey hair streaming out behind her like the comet's tail. Closer and closer she came until her nose was nearly touching mine. The odour of garlic on her breath was so overwhelming that when she spoke, I could smell every word.
"Blimey," she said. "You do know your saints, don't you?"
I was afraid that her next question would be to ask my name, but I needn't have worried.
"Who's this, then?"
she asked, pointing to the group of men who were being forced to walk the plank. Was it my imagination, or did one of them look uncannily like Orlando Whitbread? I had only seen him dead, of course, so it was difficult to tell. "The Seven Martyrs of Dyrrhachium," I said, ticking them off on my fingers. "Germanus, Hesychius, Lucian, Papius, Peregrinus, Pompeius, and Saturninus. Alphabetically, that is." I did not tell her that I had once won a prize by being able to regurgitate those names on demand. Poor Father Duffy, back in Hindley, was probably still shaking his head at the defeat of his house Goliath, Mary Rose Trethaway, who had a photographic memory, but whom fate had dealt a losing hand when I was given her question by mistake. Feely, who knew him from one of the music festivals, had tipped me off that Father Duffy was obsessed with the Albanian martyrs, and that they were more likely than not to be hauled out of the hat like white rabbits in order to defeat the Bishop's Lacey home team. I had got their names off by heart by making a mnemonic of the first letters of the martyrs' names. "Give him large portions of potted plums and strychnine. G-H-L-P-P-P-S. Germanus, Hesychius, Lucian, Papius, Peregrinus, Pompeius, and Saturninus." Just like that, and I had come away with the trophy, a rather cheesy china teacup with my name, misspelled, painted on the back by Mary Margaret Tackerberry, the captain of the Crafts League. I didn't notice until I got home that the Virgin Mary on the front of the cup was sticking out her tongue.
"Very impressive," Mrs. Dandyman said, turning to the skinned man.
"Saint Bartholomew," I said, "the patron saint of tanners."
"And this?"
"The bloke on the barbecue," I asked, becoming more sure of myself by the minute. "That's easy, Saint Lawrence. I believe they still have the grill on display in a church in Rome." Before she could question me further, it was time to gain the upper hand. I pointed to the woman escaping from the dragon's gut. "Margaret of Antioch. The dragon is the devil in disguise. Serves him right. You'd think that he, of all people, would know that crucifixes are not just used against vampires." Mrs. Dandyman lifted one of St. Bartholomew's candles out of its socket and held it up in front of my face. For a long time she examined my features, moving her light from right to left.
"I've seen you before somewhere," she said, "but I can't for the life of me remember where."
I shrugged.
"I'm just a girl," I said, hating myself even as I said it. "Ever so many girls have mousy hair. I'm just one of the mice."
"Sometimes you must manufacture camouflage with whatever is within easy reach, which, in this case, was my mouth. And my brain, of course." I needed to divert her attempt to put a name to my face. She might have seen my photograph in the newspaper not long ago.
"I feel that I can trust you, Mrs. Dandyman, but you must give me your word that you won't share with a soul what I'm about to confide in you."
"Who, in the entire history of the world since Adam and Eve, has ever been able to resist so downright juicy an offer?"
"I give you my word," she said, already licking her lips in anticipation.
I touched the back of her hand with my fingers to change her promise into an unbreakable bond. "I'm the one who found Orlando Whitbread's body," I said, and I watched her eyes. "I need to talk to you." Chapter 13.
"Orlando?" she gasped. "He's dead?"
Even by the warm light of the flickering flames, I could see the colour draining from her face, an effect which is virtually impossible to fake, and goodness knows I've tried. If this woman wasn't honestly shocked, she was the greatest actress I had ever seen.
"When?"
she asked.
"Where? What happened?"
"This morning," I told her, "in the river."
"Was it suicide?"
I said nothing, a trick I had learned from Inspector Hewitt, which had proved to be one of the most useful weapons in my arsenal.
"But no, that's not possible," she said, answering her own question.
"That's simply not possible."
"Perhaps it was an accident," I suggested, sparing her what I believed to be the truth, at least for the time being.
"Not likely," she insisted. "Orlando grew up on the river bank."
I continued my silence.
"He was always as much at home in the water as Mole and Ratty. Boats, swimming, fishing. I'm surprised he hadn't grown gills."
I recognized at once that she was referring to the animal characters from The Wind in the Willows.
"Always?"
I asked, choosing my question with care.
"It seems like always. Shadrach Circus has been coming here year in and year out since the old man himself, blast him, was alive."
"Your father?" I asked, meaning Shadrach, whomever he might be. This produced an ironic and tight little laugh.
"My great step-uncle," she said. "He was a monster. Even the tigers lived in fear of him. In the days when we had tigers, I mean. Nowadays we only have one, Sir Ladin, near blind and toothless. He only growls because his bones ache."
"So you've known Orlando for a long time," I said helpfully.
"Since he was a boy, poor lad. He used to beg us to take him away with us. Not that he had any illusions of becoming a showman, but simply to escape from his father."
"Canon Whitbread," I said, matter-of-factly, "the one who—" Mrs. Dandyman held up a restraining hand.
"Yes, that one. Say no more about it. I find it distressing."
"But I thought everyone loved Canon Whitbread."
"And so they did, until he did away with three harmless old ladies who dared disagree with him. Love can forgive only so many murders."
She was being ironic. I was quite sure of it. Daffy had once explained to me that irony consisted of words from another world, that they did not seem to mean what you thought they meant, which was a contradiction in itself.
"They're words from the other side of the looking-glass," Daffy told me, "and ought always to be answered as such."
Could I trust Daffy? In cases like this, I had no other choice. I took a deep breath, counted to three, looked Mrs. Dandyman in the eye, and asked, "How many murders have you forgiven?"
"None," she answered, "nor will I, ever."
I was flabbergasted by her words. Here was a woman after my own heart. How I rejoiced in meeting her. And yet, I mustn't let her know. In my own short life, I had come to believe that murder is unforgivable. Perhaps in time, when I was older, I would come to see things differently, though for now I was happy enough to be lumped with St. Augustine, who prayed for purity, but, as he said, not yet.
"Who were they?" I asked. "The women he did away with, I mean."
"The Three Graces, we used to call them, if somewhat inaccurately. Two Graces and an Annie, in fact. But there's no sense in nicknames, is there? Grace Willoughby, Grace Harcourt, and Annie Cray. Faith, Hope, and Treachery. The weird sisters, others called them."
"Were they actually sisters?"
"Good Lord, no. It was just that they all stirred the cauldron of gossip more than was good for them, or for anyone else. There's nothing so deadly as an acid tongue, driven by a pious mind. That's what Canon Whitbread said in one of his last sermons."
"Just before he poisoned them?" I asked.
"Some say that, yes."
"And you?"
"I keep to myself," Mrs. Dandyman replied.
She turned back to her easel, and I suspected I was being dismissed. I was, after all, trespassing.
"Why martyrs?" I blurted. "Why do you paint only martyrs?"
"This world we live in," she said, keeping her back to me, "is made up of saints and sinners, and of the two, there's a shortage of saints. It's as simple as that."
But was it?
Did her words, which seemed to me to come too easily, as if she'd been asked this question before, mean that she saw it as her duty to supply the world with saints, even painted ones? Or to rid the world of sinners?
"Flavia," I thought, "you are developing a suspicious mind."
"One more question, if I may," I persisted, "and then I'll leave you to your work." She didn't answer, so I asked it anyway. "Who hated Orlando enough to kill him?" Mrs. Dandyman spun round and dropped her brush, splattering the hem of her dress and the legs of the easel with an axe-murderous scarlet.
"Nobody," she exclaimed, "and don't you dare suggest otherwise. Don't you dare even think about it."
"What about Poppy Mandrill?" I asked brazenly. If I were to be tossed out on my ear, I desperately needed one last morsel of information.
"Out!" Mrs. Dandyman shouted. "Out with you before I call the police!"
I wondered idly how she could carry out this threat with no telephone in the Pentechnicon, but it was no time to anger the woman further. "I'm sorry," I said, and walked out the door, down the folding steps, and into the sunshine, my head in the air, not sorry in the least. On the far side of the market square, Constable Otter was engaged in conversation with the three roustabouts, Terence, Nigel, and Cornell. I put on a carefree expression, and with a careless whistle, became absorbed in kicking an empty ginger beer bottle ahead of me as I walked. The greatest thing about being 12 is that you can turn it on and off as the situation requires. The instant Constable Otter spotted me, he touched the front of his helmet with a long forefinger and made a beeline toward me. I angled away slightly, not too obviously, I hoped, and began to tack back toward the oaken pheasant. It was no use. The blasted man had me on his radar and changed course even as I did. He reminded me of Inspector Bucket in Bleak House, that relentless hound who seemed to be everywhere at the same time.
"Mr. Luce," he called out.
Picking up speed slightly and changing direction again, I pretended I hadn't heard him.
"Mr. Luce," he called again, more persistent this time.
I couldn't possibly evade him without breaking into a full gallop. By now he was at my heels, and with my peripheral vision, I could see that he was reaching for my arm. I did the only thing I could think of. I stopped dead in my tracks. Constable Otter crashed into me at speed, and down I went, arc over teakettle into the dust. Intentionally, of course. I lay there looking dazed, allowing the man to scramble to his feet, pick up his helmet, dust himself off, and regain his dignity. Meanwhile, I began, slowly and painfully, contorting my limbs into the most bizarre angles I could conjure up on a moment's notice from my monkey ancestors. Laboriously, I hauled myself to my knees. I set my drooping head to vibrating at high speed, like the clangor on an alarm clock, as if I were on the verge of a seizure, all the while groping for my elbows, knees, shoulders, and giving off a few pitiful moans.
"Are you all right?" he asked. "I'm sorry, but—"
"Shappened," I said, slurring the word and letting my tongue thicken and loll out the corner of my mouth.
"Hoss hit me."
It wasn't a bad plan to raise the spectre of concussion right at the outset.
"I'm sorry," the constable said again, reaching for my elbow to help me up, but I shook him off.
A small crowd had begun to gather. I gaped at them blearily, letting my eyes roll a little, as if I had never seen human beings before. I grasped Otter's hand and hauled myself agonizingly to my feet.
"What's she done, then, Constable?" a man in rubber boots called out. "Broke into the Bank of England?"
In spite of my grave injuries, most of the onlookers laughed at this sudden flash of wit.
"He attacked her," called out a small bird-like woman with white hair and spectacles the thickness of railway signal lamps. "I saw it with my own two eyes."
Another laugh went up.
"Pick on someone your own size, Jimmy," the rubber-booted man called out.
I could see that, round his official police collar, Constable Otter was turning red as rubies. I decided that he had had enough.
"'S all right," I said. "My fault. I tripped. I shouldn't have stopped so."
I rolled my eyes again, fishing for an elusive word.
"Fashed," I concluded triumphantly.
There, I had done it. Constable Otter was suddenly beaming upon me like some pagan sun god of beaten gold.
"Are you all right?" I asked, reaching out a solicitous but trembling hand toward him for extra points. I shook my head to clear it, and then I took his arm. "I'm still a little shaky," I said. "Perhaps you could walk me back to the Oak and Pheasant, and you can question me over a nice cup of tea."
That's how it's done, at least in my books. And so it came to pass that P.C. Otter and I were alone at last in the saloon bar of the Oak and Pheasant, safely away from any danger of being overheard.
"Please have a seat, Constable," I said. The place was my residence, after all, even if only temporarily. Besides, it cost nothing to be polite.
"Thank you, miss," he said, pulling his inevitable notebook from his pocket. "But I'm on duty."
"I hope you won't mind if I sit," I said. "I'm sorry to be so much trouble. I expect your wife will be wondering what's become of you."
"No, she won't," he replied, "as I don't have a wife. Now then, about the, deceased, which you discovered in the river this morning."
"Orlando Whitbread?" I asked,
as if I had an endless string of corpses up my sleeve, which I suppose in a way I did.
"How did you know his name?"
he pounced, his pencil poised.
"Poppy Mandrill was screaming it. You could hear her a mile away. Besides, everyone in the county knows it by now."
Constable Otter made a brief scribble in his notebook as he arranged his features into a look of official gravity.
"You're not withholding anything from me, are you, miss?"
"Withholding?"
I wanted to add, "What could I possibly be withholding?" But with the slip of paper from Orlando's trousers still soggy in my pocket, I didn't want to say too much. I was beginning to learn that in criminal investigation, as in chair design and poetry, less is more. At that moment, the landlord appeared with the tray of tea I had ordered on the way in.
"I've brought a few shortbread biscuits," Mr. Palmer said. "Some people like a few shortbread biscuits with their tea."
Since neither I nor the constable said anything, he gave the table a quick wipe and left us to our discussion. I took a biscuit and dipped it into my tea. Etiquette be hanged.
"I expect Scotland Yard will be arriving at any moment," I remarked pleasantly, "and I shall be grilled again. It's such a bore, isn't it?"
"Scotland Yard?" Constable Otter said, not touching his tea. "Why would we bring in the Yard? They're not called out for every little accident, you know."
He shook his head and gave me a rueful smile.
"What would they think if we bothered them with every bruise, every skinned knee?" he said, glancing pointedly at my own knee, which was scraped raw from my tumble. I hadn't even noticed.
So he still believed Orlando's death to be an accident, did he? Not worth reporting.
Investigation wrapped up in ribbons by the local constable. A discreet inquest which would find that the victim met his death through misadventure. A trip in the dark. Nobody's fault. Case closed. Which left the field to me. If I played my hand properly, I would get to the bottom of this affair and present it myself
solved, to the appropriate inspector at the yard, providing I could discover who he was. And perhaps, yes, perhaps, I could ring up Inspector Hewitt and lay the whole thing at his feet, much as a dog brings a bone. The important thing was to lie low, to say nothing to anyone. From here on in, I would be as silent as the tomb. I took a last sip from my teacup and set it back on the saucer, taking great care to let my hand shake enough to produce a noticeable clatter of chinaware. "I'm afraid I'm not as well as I thought I was," I said to Constable Otter, summoning up a sickly, insipid smile. "I still feel quite shaken. If you'll excuse me, I think I'll go to my room and lie down." I could see the relief on his face. No more competition, he was thinking, no more interference from that deluse brat. In his eyes, I was already a dead duck. "Well, quack, quack, quack!" I had just reached the top of the stairs when Mrs. Palmer came suddenly out of her room. She seemed surprised to see me. "Oh, there you are," she said. "Did the undertaker find you?" "Undertaker?" I asked, genuinely puzzled. "Mr. Nightingale. He was looking for you. Arvin told him you were in the saloon bar with Constable Otter. Didn't he look in?" "No," I said. "Perhaps he didn't want to disturb us. Did he say what it was about?" "He was looking for his son. Thought you might have been the last to see him." My heart gave a leap. "Is he missing?" I asked. "Only in a general sort of way," Mrs. Palmer replied. "Hobby's not your usual boy. Without a mother and his father busy with the graves and so forth, he comes and goes when he pleases. He wouldn't if he were my son. I'd put a string on him." I was reminded instantly of Hob and his kite, and his camera. Perhaps I could kill two birds with one stone by locating the little boy, probably gone back to Shadrach Circus, I thought, and by retrieving his processed film from the chemist's shop. But here was a pretty kettle of fish. Why would Mr. Nightingale keep clear of me when he knew I was with Constable Otter? Wasn't the constable, after all, the official eyes and ears of Volesthorpe, who probably knew to within a square yard the location of every single inhabitant at any given moment, as well as what they were up to? It simply didn't make sense. I vowed then and there to ask Mr. Nightingale that very question as soon as I was able to locate him. I was confident that he would give me a frank answer. Undertakers were, I had discovered, decent men. Once you had got past the black crepe, the polished ebony, and the closely shaven chins, they were a tribe of hail fellows well met, who enjoyed a joke as much as the next fellow, and sometimes more. But aside from that, and perhaps more importantly, they knew, not to put too fine a point upon it, where all the bodies were buried. I needed to buff up my acquaintanceship with Hobbs Dar, I realized, and I needed to do so immediately. And this was the perfect opportunity. "Thanks, Mrs. Palmer," I said. "Hob can't be far away. I saw him just a while ago. He's probably gone back for another squint at the elephant." Outside, in the garden bower, Feely and Dieter were still clutching both of each other's hands, each gazing into the eyes of the other, as if they were about to burst into song, like Jeanette MacDonald and Nelson Eddy in Maytime, or one of those boring but unsettling films featuring advanced wrestling holds. They didn't even see me, which was just as well, because I didn't wish to be seen. An older sister in love is an unexploded bomb, UXB, at the best of times. But when she's just been reunited with her intended mate after a nerve-shredding separation of more than half a year, she's as touchy and unstable as a rusty bucket of old nitroglycerine, C3H5O9N3, and consequently best steered clear of. I made my way back to the high street and to the premises of Wanless and Sons Dispensing Chemists, taking great care by stopping to gape like a tourist at the half-timbered shops and the tiny leaded windows of the adjoining houses. I dawdled on the pavement for a couple of minutes, shaking my head at the quaintness of it all. And then I stepped casually into the dimness of the shop.
"We're closed," said the man in white behind the counter. He looked as if he hadn't budged since I was here hours ago.
"I'm sorry," I replied, "but I wondered if there's the slightest chance my prints are ready. I don't mean to bother you, but there's been a family emergency, and we've been summoned home immediately."
Summoned was a perfect choice of words, I thought. It added such great gravity to the situation. He gave me that stare that chemists have. "I don't know," he said, "but I doubt it. I had to step out for a while, you understand. We're very busy."
"Howland!"
he bellowed, but this time there was no reply from the underworld. He stamped on the floorboards.
"Howland!"
"Would you mind checking?" I asked. "I'm afraid that it's... I stifled a sob. Pressure works best when applied at precisely the right moment. The chemist clicked his tongue with that sound which is usually written TCH, and which suggests martyrdom. "Give me the strength to suffer this fool gladly." Bending down, he pulled at an iron ring that was inset into the trap door and lifted it, revealing the top of a steep and narrow set of stairs, more of a ladder than anything. I leaned round the wicket for a better view, but the chemist, with that crab-like secrecy natural to his profession, scuttled down the hole, pulling the hatch closed behind him, and I, tiptoeing as silently as I could, stepped onto it. I'd have to be quick. A lightning scan of the counter did not reveal what I was hoping to find. An apothecary's pill roller of wood and marble and a brass balance were on one side, and a paper dispensing roll on the other. No, it wasn't here. It would be put away somewhere out of sight, as official objects often are. I pulled out one of the two deep drawers, in which were a surprising number of loose coins, bills, and a few slips of scribbled paper, which I guessed to be IOUs. "Don't touch, Flavia," I thought, "fingerprints and so forth." I closed the first drawer and pulled out the second. "Fortune favours girls with guts," some ancient Roman had once written, or ought to have written, because it was true. I was instantly rewarded. There, before my very eyes, was a tall, black, slender volume. Sale of Poisons Register Book was stamped on the cover in gold letters. I hauled it out and opened it. Fingerprints be hanged. It couldn't possibly be a crime to examine an official document, could it? I turned the pages with trembling fingers, beginning at the back, where the latest entries were written in a black and official-looking ink. Each page had space for four entries, each detailing the date, the name and address of the purchaser, the name and quantity of the poison sold to them, the purpose for which it was required, and their signature, along with the name of the person who had introduced the purchaser to the chemist, which, in most cases, had been signed or initialled by the chemist himself. E.B. Wanless, presumably the name of that white-jacketed gentleman who was presently rummaging around somewhere in the depths beneath my feet. My eyes widened as the secrets of Volsthorpe were laid bare. Here, in page after page, among the purchases of lead and opium to treat spasms, were the names and addresses of everyone who had bought sixpenny worth of rat poison and mouse poison, arsenic for psoriasis, or 4 pounds of it at a time, to tan or cure skins, potassium cyanide to destroy wasps' nests, or for photographic purposes. As I leafed back toward the entries of 2 years ago, a notation fairly leapt at me off the page. HCN. Prussic acid. An ounce of the stuff had been sold to the Volsthorpe Constabulary. My pulse leapt as I read the reason given for the purchase. "Poison-injured dog," it said. And it had been signed by J. R. Otter, Constable 997. A wooden clatter beneath my feet indicated that the chemist was coming back up the ladder. There was no time to waste. I shifted my brain into its speed-reading setting, tuning my eye for any occurrence of HCN, prussic acid, or cyanide. And there were, I'm sorry to say, many, most requiring an ounce to poison a dog or a cat. And Hobbs' photographer brother, Pippin Nightingale, had, in an entry dated 1st of November 1949, signed for 2 ounces of cyanide of potash, his given reason being silver bath. And in August of the same year, Canon Whitbread of the Vicarage St. Mildred's had bought 2 ounces of potassium cyanide for the purpose of destroying wasps' nests. I touched the dead man's signature with my forefinger. I pictured him standing here at this very wicket as the cyanide was handed over. What was in his mind? What was in his heart? I remembered, too, that according to Mrs. Palmer, Orlando had worked part-time at the chemist's shop, but as far as I could see, he had never signed this register, either as a buyer or a dispenser of poison. Which made sense, I suppose, since he was not licensed as a pharmaceutical dispenser. The floor was now beginning to quake beneath my feet as the chemist applied his shoulder to the trap door. A string of muffled, but still clearly naughty curses filtered up through the heavy floorboards.
"Hello?"
I called out, injecting a note of surprise into my voice as I slipped the poison register back into the drawer and shoved it shut with my hip.
"Is something wrong?"
At the same moment, with both feet still firmly on the trap, I bent down, seized the iron ring, and gave it a jolly good rattling.
"Blast!" I said in a frustrated voice, kicking at the ring. "I think it's stuck."
More chemical profanity floated up from under the floorboards.
"Hold on," I shouted. "I need to get something to lift it."
A few more heavy but useless heaves from below convinced my captive that I was telling him the truth. I smeared a bit of dust from the floor onto my cheekbones, tousled my hair, then bent and threaded one of my pigtails through the ring. Then, in one single and continuous motion, in a fluid movement that would have delighted both Sexton Blake and Philip O'Dell, the BBC wireless detective, I stepped off the trap and pulled open the hatch, using my hair as a rope. I stared down for a moment into the lobster-red face of the chemist. I held the pose just long enough that the astonished Wanless could see what I had done. Then, freeing my hair from the ring with a flick of my head, I stuck out a helping hand and began to haul him up out of the hole.
"Oh, you poor soul," I cooed, hoping it would sound genuine. "The beastly ring was jammed. I had a very dickens of a time getting it open. How brave of you not to have panicked. If it were me," I shuddered, "I should have shed a kidney."
I know, but sometimes it's necessary." I steadied his shaking arm as he came scrambling up out of the open hatch, like a sailor escaping a sinking submarine. It was easy enough to see that the man had worked himself up into a tizzy. Claustrophobia, I thought. No point in staring and embarrassing him.
"I'll just take my prints, then, and be on my way," I said, in that cheery voice that makes people want to strangle you.
I was simply dying to whistle, "Some day my prince will come," but I thought better of it.
"There are no prints," Wanless muttered, running his finger round the inside of his collar. "They didn't turn out?" I asked. My heart began to sink.
"I expect they did," he said. "Howland had to charge extra for the expedited service."
"That's all right," I said blithely. "I don't mind paying. How much will it be?"
"You don't understand," the chemist said. "Howland must have dealt with it while I was out. They've already been picked up and paid for, less than an hour ago. It's marked in his receipt book."
He pointed toward the cellar. My jaw fell open.
"Picked up by whom, may I ask?" I demanded,
stiffening my spine like Aunt Felicity. I'd show this impertinent tradesman a thing or two. They were my photographs. But wait, best not to get too shirty. Perhaps Hob